atoms, motion, and the void. A tone came to my ears, and a deeper, surrounding sound of a far-off railway thunder. This was not unexpected somehow, and not unpleasant. It was as though I had had a recurring dream of such sounds, and thereby gained familiarity. Ah yes, I thought, here are my sounds. The volume and piercing treble of the world were toggled down. Less and less I heard the raucous grift of the local way, the storming hiss and bleat of cars, the glass-dragging shatter of the rain, the brown mutter of the man on the street. The world and its sounds were being drawn down into silence. Alongside this was the feeling that I had been sealed in some glass vessel or antique diver's bell and was being dropped into the deepest ocean on some grave submariner's mission. The world was caving in upon me, but yet there persisted a capsule of safety. I was secure within some crystalline compartment, and despite the enormous oceanic compressions, no matter how deep I went, I felt that I would always be secure. There was a physical manifestation to this, as my body grew heavier and my movements slower and slower, to the point where I was quite literally not able to keep up with Sherwin on his nightly walk home. This despite the fact that Sherwin himself did not seem well. He was stumbling over his feet now, and stopping quite frequently along the way. His head hung heavy as he underwent the ebb and flow of what appeared to be his body's anguish. Two recent discoveries had been made that I suppose, with everything else, assisted in this transition. The first occurred before bedtime. I'd come through the door after my nightly vigil with Sherwin. It was after midnight, and Tristram, as usual, met me at the door. She escorted me into the study, pulled my chair out, and set the pillow down on the writing ledger. I was so tired, I dropped my face directly down onto the soft velour. But before turning off the lights, Tristram reached toward the wall and unhooked a painting, a photograph I had never closely observed. She dusted the glass surface with her palm and stood the frame before my eyes, and then, when I did nothing, leaned its coldness upon my forehead to establish her imperative. I sat back, taking the portrait into my hands as though to give it the justice of my consideration. Really, I was so tired at the moment that I only intended a cursory inspection. Indeed, Tristram was so often enigmatic, and I so often failed to follow her, that from time to time I gave myself permission, simply not to try. But after a moment or two under her close scrutiny, I felt I would not be getting away with any false attentions. So I shook myself loose of my fatigue and examined it. Under the dust-swiped glass, I could see a yellowy newspaper clipping mounted on dark board. a historical keepsake. My eyes tensed over the strange, black-and-white photograph, which depicted a horrific and furious fire from long ago. The fire was so extravagantly full that aside from a few shadowy gusts, the image was almost purely white. Tristan pointed toward the headline, which I read over to myself several times, slower with each pass. Midnight Fire Takes Antioch Homestead. Midnight Fire Takes Antioch Homestead. I looked back at the image and now saw, within the abrasive white of the fire, the faint outline of a burning porch. I nodded to Tristan my acceptance and understanding of this memento and handed it back to her for the hanging. These were days when I could neither be astonished nor perturbed. Everything that came before my eyes and life, whether it was the internal tone and thunder noise and its attendant feeling of dropping in a pressurized cabin into some infinite ocean, or Tristan Beryl Bain showing me a 40-year-old newspaper article that detailed a grisly story in which I played some part. Everything that came, came freely and left freely as it liked. I held on to nothing. The fire, which had claimed the lives of the Antioch twins, had been a signal moment in my life, as I had, under the siege of some strange boy's fever, gone into the inferno and tried to save the two infants. Not only did they perish, but I nearly did as well. As I have mentioned elsewhere, I bear its burden to this day. Tristram hung the framed article back on the wall. I was apparently not following the point of all this as she now took my hand in hers and held it, as she sometimes did, to assist me toward a more complete concentration. I simply drew my awareness to the feeling of her hand. Random thoughts rose and passed through me. Images of the fire, of the children, of the hallway as I ran down it. Tristram raised her other hand and set it gently on my cheek, as she so often did to mark the beginning or end of an activity. I had never yet had this two-handed treatment, and I felt at once a surging clarity. It was at this moment that I first became aware of the inner sound, around which grew the subtle reverberation of the railway thunder. My interest shifted from the feeling of her hands to the bell tone and the thunder, and at the moment my attention shifted, I understood. Tristram and Arthur Beryl Bain were the Antioch twins. Somehow, inexplicably, they had not died in the fire, although that is what had been reported and what I had been told. When I opened my eyes, Tristram was moved in quite close. And though I would never have any formal confirmation, Tristram did, finally, honor me with the sound of her voice. Light and pure, and just a little decorative in the way that Arthur's voice was. Artistic, baroquely flourished. Certainly I might consider her two words an indirect acknowledgement of the fact of our long ago shared experience, but I will never really know for sure, nor do I quite care. She leaned down, tightened over me, pressing her lips upon my cheek and her ornate small voice, carving each word slowly and carefully as she said, "Thank you."
One day. sneaky societies and combat boots and
if my understanding of Arta and Tristram as the unexplainably unperished Antioch twins served as the launch for my downward adventure, the second discovery widened my perception of the place into which I was dropping. Over the course of that week, Tristram had had me reading aloud from a very old book that seemed constructed of the smithereens of the forest floor. Pine needles, leaves, sticks, pith, peat, pitch, droppings, bird feathers, bones, all knuckled into a rough, book-like pastiche. The binding was of vine and knitted twigs. The cover was a smear of birch and root and lichen. The paper inside was damp and fungal, and every page had the spongy warmth of moss. In the drowsy light of the reading room, I had the impression that I was somehow turning the pages, if it can be said, of some small, strangely living creature, not quite animal, not quite plant. There was no title on the bark-like cover, but inside, on the first page, the handwritten script read, "The Book of the Bodhisattva." My downward spiral increased with every word. I literally felt my body turning to iron, plunging heavier and heavier through the thicker and thicker water as I read the old-fashioned script. It is not the purpose of this living volume to describe the goal of the Bodhisattva, or to define the terms as might be mentioned, such as unity or realization, or to explain in any way what is meant by the one true thing, but simply to explore some of the methods as they have formally developed that have assisted toward the transmission of spontaneously understood truth. The result of the Bodhisattva practice is the realization of the one true thing. For thousands of years, the practice was not a practice at all, but an unnamed, unsought, and spontaneously occurring realization of the unity of all things through the direct experience of being all things. The realization of the one true thing is at the heart of this and every spiritual practice. Anyone who has experienced the full transmission of the Bodhisattva will live forever in the simple peace that has no name. Tristram never let me read more than a paragraph or two at a time. But we did begin to read more constantly, perhaps a dozen or so times a day, she would bring me into the reading room for a brief session. Aside from the content, one of my first impressions about the book itself was that it was alive. Tristram kept it in a shallow dish, at the bottom of which lay a small puddle of what looked like gravy. As I continued on with the book, I noted little green shoots emerging from the top and side, and my fingers could feel the white tendril roots thickening on the back. As to its content, I took it to be a very simple book that led its reader toward some state, or place, or shift in perspective, by way of this Bodhisattva practice, which laid out a wide variety of means to an unelaborated upon end. My second discovery, therefore, was that I had been, without knowing it, all the while, undergoing the transformative Bodhisattva process, the means of which, in my case, had taken the form of a rather severe kind of repudiation. Many of the practices described in the book, I noted, were much less violent and fantastical. They were enviable and gentle practices, such as sitting beneath particular, easygoing trees until the sattva state had manifested. Other practitioners, according to their need, might walk through the world, or write endlessly, or talk about their inner experience, or exhaust themselves in physical activity. It all depended on the shape of one's inner self and the depth of one's own self-fascination. But I suppose I already knew that I was an intractable, high-minded type. The means to my sattva end would require explosives, a jackhammer, and other elaborate domination, as I read. For those strongly anchored to their suffering selves, there is finally the very powerful practice of remote self-observation. By this, it is suggested that a double or stand-in be allowed to assume the life of the practitioner, with the practitioner then observing his or her double from some distance until the original identity is loosened because of its onerous complexity and the involvement of at least a second party. Remote self-observation is rarely undertaken. It should be noted that the practice of remote self-observation is often accompanied by the gift of shared transmigration. Literally, the death of the doppelganger is observed and even experienced by the original host. Historically, the stand-in, having arrived near their own proximate death due to disease or age, offers the use of his or her body for the sacred purpose. The practitioner is thereby given the rare opportunity of seeing themselves, in essence, die. When I finally finished reading the book and tried to close it shut, I found my body paralyzed with heaviness and beyond my possession. I could not move. My eyes were glazed with some kind of unknown ether. A series of fast-growing roots had emerged from the book to wrap loosely around my wrist. My fingers as well, I could feel, were being wrapped in the hemp-like strands. My body leached its leaden essence into the chair, straining downward. Tristram held a brief note before me which read, "You will spend the following days with Sherwin until his end." Time stopped. Only my eyes retained their freedom. There was no sound available. Even the tone and railway thunder had been swallowed away by an absolute, breathtaking silence. Men entered the reading room, and I was pleased to recognize Mr. Cassidy among them. Three or four stalwarts at first, and then more. Six, seven, eight. Their hands came beneath my arms and legs, and I was hoisted with difficulty into the air and set on a kind of makeshift gurney. The moon floated above us, the stars in their scatter. We were moving down Fourth Avenue. Clouds were lowering in like heavy curtains. The thin, skeletal branches of the trees scribbled above us. The book in my hands continued to weave the root of its living unguent around my wrist and arm, driving itself in a kind of organic rhapsody of earth and flesh, disappearing upon my arms, diving into me. A part of my being drank at it, sipped toward the pulsing ointment of its energy, as though the book and I were one. And as we passed the Gresham Park, which I detected only through an observation of the ornamental fence topping, all distinctions between myself and the world suddenly failed. I was the fence, the sticks, the moon, the book, the stars, the men, the gurney, the cold air, the dark night sky. And as I moved into the understanding of no difference between flesh and earth, between blood and starlight, between material and void, as we hastened along toward the William Pines rooming house and the dying show in sleeves, I saw that this recognition in itself was the only basis there could ever be for that ineffable thing I had so long misunderstood and misperceived and misjudged, that I had always taken love as a constructed alignment of liking and lusting, of caring and familiarity and support, of duty and enjoyment, and as a softening salve to the fear of death and the cold-fingered cabin of loneliness, when all along it was this other, somehow unperceived force and movement, of the recognition of no difference, not an action undertaken or a cultivated experience, but the simplest fundamental property of all things, the unseen, unfelt force that both steered the boat and was the river.
Out of our context and seeming issues, laughter rings inside. So easily. everything's different.
I seem to come and go with no reason, awake one minute, asleep the next. I was in Sherwin's room, sitting or standing. Candles were burning, and there was a wild, peaceful scent of sage and death smoke. He lay in the bed before me, in a sickly, conflicted fever that wetted his forehead and dried his lips. His eyes were burning wide, his mouth blackly open. The greater whole of his body seemed dead, still and useless but for the occasional trembling wave. But there were a few remaining places, his eyes, his fingers, his mind, and in these places he was concentratedly alive. Sherwin had, over the days I'd observed him, been on a slow and steady decline. To see him now was to see a man in the mumbling, warm trouble of his final hours. I saw him, and he saw me. And there was a relief in this contact for the both of us. There were the stalwarts all around in the back tapestry of the room in the golden candle shadows. Tristram sat on the far side of the bed, her hand upon his cheek. So kind of her, I thought, to do this wherever she went. There was no surgery to be done here, no medication to be tried. Just this kind of touching and holding forth, this bearing along, this abiding. Though he squirmed and buckled against whatever went unfastening within his body, he did not seem frustrated, or bothered, or frantic, or engaged in any attempted escape or rejection of what was happening. On the contrary, he was absolutely tuned for it. He was riding these fatal waves in fullest alertness and readiness, as though tumbling along the hard final way in a disintegrating cart. Dying was an exertion toward a participated action, like eating or breathing, both directed and autonomic. But this was the exertion of release, of dropping one's heavy bags, of giving the arthritic fingers permission to let go of their lifelong grip. To let go, and let go some more. Releasing, removing all attachment, letting the original wildness return. Sherwin filled the entire area of my concentration. So strongly was my observation of him, and so obscured was my body with paralysis, that rather than being a person in the room, I was more like the space of the room itself, and even inside that, becoming the wide-open space of his death. I made warm room for him, made wide the ocean bed upon which he would soon lay. I welcomed him with the arms of the universe, and there came the sensation of his needing assistance, and I moved into his body like a strange night nurse to take on some portion of that burden of his pain, and therein, like a morphine ghost, to inhabit the rockiest briar and absorb the sharpest cut, that his path be clear in its final stretch. Us two together now, wordless. Something absorbed and moved off. Something came and then departed. Something occurred and went back. I was holding the power of his heart as he held mine, and we lay together in a blind embrace, knowing only the fullest expression of life. For us both then, everything was forgotten, and then again redoubled and remembered afresh. In a rushing rainbow crystal, every image, every story, every observation of my life in a torrent of light. And I said farewell to each in the only way one can, with the kiss of forgiveness. There was a rapidly arriving sense of churning hard and upward through a thick liquid, our bodies cutting to the distant surface. For so long I had descended, and now we were coming up for air, hastening with lightning speed, upward, upward, upward in a hot foaming explosion, until suddenly the surface of the cold black sea glistened 1,000 miles below. We floated just here in the loose contour of the galaxy, in a liquid warmth of stillness and silence. And then soon we began our digression. My energy weakened, and I began to drop back toward the dark sea below, as he inclined into an unknown merger, neither upward nor backward, but somehow tucking into the very fold of the green-black sparkling sky. There are no words that handle it, and no way to express the final and fundamental shift in my perspective at the moment of our death. Much later on, I wrote down the following, but it does no justice to the simple truth. To know that nothing can be saved, held, or kept. To know that nothing can be touched, seen, heard, or felt. That there is nothing ever else to learn, and never anywhere to go. Nothing to add, increase, enlarge, better, further. To release all custody over people, all intention over things. To have no control, nothing to own, no more appointments, not a single worry, no need or urge, nothing to satisfy, no lack or incompletion, no something in the corner that needs mending, no place to go, no one to visit, nothing to fight, none to injure, bind, tie, manipulate, or confuse, no one home, no car to drive, no shoes to wear, no coats to clean, nothing left to tie or fold, nothing left to borrow, make, move, or transfer. To know that one must travel deeply and steadfastly into the dream of one's own self, to explore the full weight of the tyranny of, and the suffering of, and the forgiveness of that which is called the original sin, which is itself alone and simply the illusion that one is a person, privately held, separate from all others, distinct from the world, a fragment set in space, complete unto oneself, and capable of unique action. To learn that what one calls real is in fact a dream. To learn that what one believes is itself the material to be transcended. The blessing of this grace is to be possessed by an indifference to anything not essential, and to surrender oneself endlessly into every moment without demand. To know that one dies into the vortex of one's birth, and that all beings, animals, and matter, whether stone or tree, bear forth from the self-same emptiness and return there when complete. To die in one's own arms, as ever one has been, invisible, strong, transparent, clear, cradled thereby in the crucible of the hands of God, which is nothing but love, which is nothing but the universe, which is nothing but the self, which then in its fulfillment may be said to be comprised of this trinity alone, of atoms, motion, and the void.